You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I want to follow up on the episode I did last week where I was looking at the DEI rollbacks that we have seen in recent weeks. And as I had said, all of them had initially been started because the Trump administration rolled back affirmative action in federal agencies. And so a lot of companies have used this as an excuse to roll back on their initiatives around DEI. Some of these companies are the ones I spoke about last week, and I focused on Target, but I also mentioned H&M and McDonald's and Coca-Cola and like many of these companies basically who were never that committed to DEI anyway. And I also looked at some of the internal politics of DEI and also just the umbrella of people of color. Like sometimes people argue that it's not a useful category because it encapsulates so many different people and groups of people whose interests aren't necessarily always aligned. And to that, I spoke about the Asian American communities lobbying the Supreme Court to remove affirmative action from higher education, and how their success essentially highlights how there's internal struggles for power within the POC umbrella and also within the DEI umbrella. I spoke about how within the LGBT movement, for example, or the LGBT umbrella, there's a lack of diversity even in who is centered or who gets to make decisions, namely that women are often left as like an add-on or an afterthought, and how they're often not in positions of power to dictate how events or how the movement is presented and represented. Now, at the end of the episode, I talked about how I wanted to look at the history of some of these companies because I think they explain, one, why they are the companies who are most likely to roll back DEI initiatives because they were never committed to them because their history is kind of plagued with a lot of racism and sexism. I'm going to focus on the racism part today. And the second reason is because they've made a lot of their money from inequality, and so it makes sense that they would never be that devoted to DEI. And I wanted to pick a company that showcase those two points, but also that kind of showed the enduring legacy that racism has in institutions in the modern day and how those institutions won't. Because sometimes when we think about like companies that operated during slavery or during colonization or during like periods of inequity, we kind of think of them as like companies that existed then, and we disconnect them from companies that exist now. But the thing is that many of those companies were the most profitable of their times. And so because they were the most profitable of those times, of their times, they have enduring capacity. They're able to endure for long periods of time because they have that generational wealth, shall you say, that institutional generational wealth. The company I want to talk about specifically today is Citigroup, and I want to talk about them in the context of their involvement of Haiti because I just think it's such an interesting story, and it really showcases the predatory nature of capitalism and the predatory nature of the banking industry, and how those institutions, like I said, have like an enduring capacity. Like they were founded in 1812 and they still exist today, and during that period it has been marked by just completely unethical practices. So to give you a little bit of a background on Citigroup before I start on the history, on its history with Haiti. Citigroup, if you don't know, is one of the biggest institutions in the US. It's the third largest bank by assets. It was initially founded in 1812. And back then it wasn't called Citigroup. It was called the Citibank of New York because it only operated nationally and specifically in New York. But later on, it got a mandate to operate nationally, and so it changed its name from Citibank of New York to National Citibank of New York. And then somewhere along the way, it became known as Citigroup, as we know it now, and Citi being spelt with an I as opposed to a Y. It's headquartered in New York, as it has always been headquartered since its inception. Right now, or at least as of 2024, it has 230,000 employees globally and offices in 54 countries, although it actually operates in 180 countries because of the subsidiaries that it has. Now, I mention its background because it really tells you how big it is of an institution, how powerful of an institution, and how far reaching of an institution it is. And therefore, if it is that big and is that powerful and is that far reaching, it means that the negative or positive things that it does is amplified. So when it does terrible things, it's amplified because it is in so many different places, in so many different countries. Also, it has financed and founded so many other businesses. If you look at its shareholding, because it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, you will see that it owns like shares in McDonald's, in Nvidia, in Costco, in Netflix, in Pepsi, in ExxonMobil, in Walmart, in Johnson & Johnson. Like, think of any sector and they will be in there. Think of any big corporation that is publicly listed, and chances are that Citigroup is an investor in that company. And therefore, what it means is that they have massive influence over what other corporations do, because not only do they have influence as a shareholder, because large shareholders often influence what the board decides to adopt as policies and has a trickle-down effect on how the business operates, but they also have influence as just being a massive company, in that if they are like the top three financial institutions in the United States, it means that they're going to be trendsetters as far as policies around the environment, for example, or social issues, like where they move, other follow. So if they adopt environmentally friendly standards, as we have seen, for example, that has a trickle-down effect on the rest of the market, not just in the financial institutions, but also company cultures in general. That's also the case when it comes to their adoption or winding up of DEI initiatives, in that it doesn't just affect Citigroup, it affects the companies they are shareholders in, and it also has an effect on the wider company culture within the United States, particularly where financial institutions are concerned, but also just in general, because again, as I said, they're so heavily invested in all these different types of companies from all these different types of industries. So they've got massive influence. Now, before going to talk about how Citigroup essentially colonized Haiti, it's worthwhile taking a step back and looking at the context of Haiti at the time before they arrived. And Haiti had been under French occupation for a very long time. And that's a very polite way of saying they were colonized and the population was enslaved. And they were forced to labor on these plantations that produced sugar and coffee and cotton. And the money from one, the produce and the money that came from the sale of these produce all went back towards the French government for French people to benefit from. They had about 500,000 enslaved Africans living on the island at the time. And after a few centuries of this, basically the treatment of the Haitian population, of the enslaved African population, basically became increasingly worse, to the point where French soldiers who had, you know, been moved to the island as like a permanent occupation, they engaged in some of the most sadistic forms of torture and humiliation you can imagine. Like, think of it. Think of any evil thing that a person could do to another person, and they've done worse than that. So eventually the population, under this level of brutality and the exploitation and just sheer torture, started rebelling at around 1789. But really the date that is put in the calendar as like the definitive date of when Haiti began its revolt against the French invasion or the French occupation was the 22nd of August, 1791. What follows next is not a quick victory for the Haitians. They ended up being at war with the French for 14 long, hard years. So their liberation was incredibly hard fought for. Now, unfortunately, what ends up happening is the French come back a few years later and they basically say, we want compensation for the loss of property and income that we have suffered because of slavery ending, essentially. And the Haitian government, probably fatigued from fighting for so long and under fear that the French were going to send more soldiers and looking at a population that was weary and tired from fighting, they end up agreeing to paying them reparations. They end up paying those reparations for a century, and the last payment was in 1947. Now, alongside this, don't forget, Haiti ends up getting its liberation in 1804, but slavery isn't actually abolished in America until 1865. And so what ends up happening is that Haiti ends up being completely economically isolated. The Americas won't trade with it. And many of the other sort European countries who had colonies in the Caribbean and in Latin America, they also essentially isolated Haiti, because what they feared was that their win, their ability to liberate themselves from their enslavers, they feared that that would send a message to, for example, the enslaved population in the United States, and that that would essentially incentivize them or embolden them into fighting for their own liberation. So they strangled them economically, and that was very much reflected in the economic status of Haiti when Citigroup started its meddling and started its campaign for its colonization by the firm. Now, this is where Citigroup enters the scene. And as early back as the 1910s, Citigroup had been trying to persuade the US government to invade and occupy Haiti. Now, the reason why it wanted that was, one, part of it was like a civilizing mission. Like, one of the things that colonizers always said when they were invading these countries was that they wanted to bring civilization. They viewed them as like these barbarians who had no civility. And the idea was basically to civilize them at the end of a rifle, or to civilize them with at the bottom of a boot. So basically, like, part of the motivation for Citigroup and for companies like Citigroup and for countries like the United States, it was basically like a racist ideology that centered around the idea that white people were enlightened and intelligent and capable of governing themselves, whereas countries with people of color weren't. And so they lobbied the government partly because of that. But another second reason was because they wanted to control the central bank of Haiti, because that would make them the exclusive bank of the country, which means that they would have control of all deposits made in the country. So they were trying to secure their own monopoly over the private and public finances of Haiti. So anyway, they lobbied the government for a few years from the 1910s up until 1915 or so. And in 1915, that's when the US government decides to invade Haiti. So they invade them in 1915 and they stay in the country up until 1934. And one of the things that you should notice just even around Haiti is the narrative around US invasions in other countries really hasn't changed that much. Like, the narrative that they always give is that the reason why they need to have military occupation is to help the domestic population of these faraway countries govern themselves. So they're like, we want to bring political stability, we want to bring democracy, we want to bring economic stability, and we basically are going to have our soldiers be in your country until you are able to govern yourself. It's the same narrative they used in Syria, in places like Libya. It's also the rationale they gave after they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. They were like, well, we can't leave now because there's so much chaos, so we're gonna have to stay for the next like 20 years up until the point where the Iraq population and the Afghanistan population can govern themselves, essentially. So honestly, like, look around the world and this narrative is always followed, and it's the same narrative that was given when they decided to occupy Haiti. Because Haiti before 1915, so the period between it getting its independence and in 1915 when the US occupied it, it had been marked by large periods of time when there was like incredible political instability, where presidents were assassinated or kidnapped, or there was insurrections, or there were coups. And a lot of these coups, honestly, were US financed. But basically, they created the political instability within Haiti to justify its occupation, as has kind of been well chronicled in like other countries, particularly in South America. So anyway, going back to the occupation between 1915 and 1934, one of the biggest things that happens is that Citigroup gets exactly what it wants. So not only does it end up being the biggest shareholder of the Central Bank of Haiti, initially they're the biggest shareholder, but then after they buy out like other investors, quote unquote, and other shareholders like the French government, they end up having exclusive control of the national government, which means that all the money that was generated in the economy in the country of Haiti, in the island of Haiti, was controlled and governed by Citigroup and its staff. Another consequence, actually, of Citigroup becoming the exclusive owner of the central bank, it's not called the Central Bank of Haiti, I think it's called the National Bank of Haiti, but it's a central bank, like the treasury, essentially. One of the consequences is that because it had bought the debt from France, so remember, as I said before, when Haiti gains its independence, the French come back and they say, you're going to pay us reparations. So the Haitians start paying reparations in the mid-1810s, shall we say. And they're paying them for a very long time. But when the country falls under U.S. occupation, that debt is bought from the French by Citigroup. So what happens then for a period of time, for the 30 years that Haiti was under occupation, was that they were paying reparations to Citigroup. So Citigroup was getting the money that Haitians were forced to pay their former enslavers for the loss of access to Haitians' enslaved labor and for the loss of property, and that property being not only the plantations, but also the Haitians themselves. So basically, they're paying that now to Citigroup. Now, that's like the first direct connection between Citigroup and it's like benefiting from slavery, because it's getting the reparations that used to be paid to the French government because they bought the debt from the French, and they've been able to access that by basically stealing the Central Bank of Haiti. Now, the other way in which they benefited directly from the exploitation of the Haitians was that one of the crazy things was that they just walked into, even before the U.S. occupation, they had a mission where they showed up on the island and under support from the U.S. government, who were in like plain clothes, like under the military that was dressed in plain clothes, they walk up into Haiti's central bank and they just take like $500,000 in worth of gold in like yesteryear's currency or equivalent. They take $500,000 worth of gold and they just like walk out of the central bank. They're protected from all the way when they're going through the island with the gold. They end up boarding vessels that were waiting for them and they sail away back to the United States with that gold. And that gold goes straight to the vaults of Citigroup. So that's the second connection. Now, the third connection is that the vice president of the bank, of Citigroup Bank, which was at that time, as I said, called the National City Bank of New York, the VP was also the head of Haiti's central bank. So he was a guy called Roger Farnham. And whilst Haiti technically at the time had its own president, which was a puppet regime, a puppet government installed by the U.S. government, in effect, the person who actually had the most power was Roger Farnham as the head of National City Bank of New York that controlled the National Bank of Haiti, Haiti's central bank. And so for the time that Haiti was under U.S. occupation, it effectively means that Citigroup, like directly through one of its employees, the highest level of its employees, was the one that was administering the financial policies that exploited Haitians. And I say exploited because not only were they effectively stealing from the Haitians, because what the National Bank of Haiti was doing under the City Bank of New York, or the National City Bank of New York, which is Citigroup, what they were doing was that they were taking Haitian money and shipping it directly to the United States. So all the money that was deposited, all the taxation that was paid, all the revenue that was generated by the country, by its citizens, was not only controlled by Citigroup as the head of the central bank and the owners and shareholders of the national bank, but also they directly took the money from Haitian territory and put it in the United States. And you will not be surprised that in the United States, where they put it was in Citigroup banks. And also, by the way, just to clarify, when I say Roger Farnham and I talk about the VP, that's not to imply that it was one person from Citigroup. It was the organization as a whole that controlled the National Bank of Haiti and therefore that set the monetary policy and financial policy within the country. Another way in which they exploited the Haitians was that there was all kinds of like racist stuff. Like they wouldn't extend loans to the local population. Second, when they did extend loans, they made it on like incredibly predatory rates, where the interest rates being paid was just completely exploitative. Another thing they did was that because the National Bank and other important other important roles within the government was controlled by U.S. figures and figures from Citigroup, they ended up paying themselves like incredible salaries. So much in salaries that they neglected funding just like basic social services in the country. So in one of the years, the salaries that Citigroup and U.S. government officials paid themselves was like five times the amount of money that was being spent on Haitian education system as a whole. So predatory in all these different levels. The final thing I will mention in terms of the financial exploitation of Haiti by Citigroup was that they also are directly responsible for the financial instability that Haiti finds itself in now. Because pre the occupation that was at the behest of Citigroup and that benefited Citigroup the most as an organization, before then, Haiti had been a diligent payer of its external debt. So not a single year between its independence in 1804 up until the occupation by the U.S. in 1915 had it missed a single payment to its external debt holders, who was primarily France, essentially. What happens after the occupation of the United States and Citigroup is that because Citigroup and its officials are spending so much money on just lavishness for themselves, they end up neglecting paying the external debt that was owed to countries like France. So what happens is that Haiti ends up owing more money, because when you miss repayments, obviously what happens is that you're charged extra interest rates. So because Citigroup, through the central bank, neglects paying these external obligations, Haiti ends up owing more money in the long term. The second thing is that this Citigroup, through the central bank, ends up like taking on all these extra loans from other countries, and they take them out under like the name of Haiti, under Haiti's name. And they basically say the reason why they need these loans is to finance the construction of the island. They say they're going to build roads and infrastructure and railways and all these like great things that are going to bring economic prosperity to Haiti, allegedly. Of course, that never materializes. And in fact, what they do with the loans that they have taken out is that they just spend it on themselves. They spend it on lavish expenses for themselves, things like buying automobiles for every representative of government and for Citigroup workers, and also spend the money on their own salaries. And the net effect of that is that even to this day, or up until like a few years ago, up until like 2013, when some of the debt that Haiti had was canceled after they like suffered a catastrophic earthquake, was that Haiti was still paying off some of these debts that Citigroup, when it was in the country under U.S. occupation, had accrued. And I think that's really relevant, because sometimes when we talk about historical injustices, we kind of forget that the past is like the recent past and that it's connected to now. So sometimes when we think about like companies like Citigroup and Haiti, like you forget that what Citigroup did in 1915 up until 1934, and to be honest, for a long period after that, it still had an effect on Haiti up until 2013 for sure, because for one, they were still paying off some of those debts that Citigroup accrued when they controlled Haiti. But also in terms of the lasting effects, like what lasting effects is there going to be when a company steals the nation's wealth for like a period of 30 years and never pays any reparations or never pays any of that back? Of course, the consequences are going to like ripple through up until now. So sometimes it's like a disconnect, and we kind of want to make it seem as though the past is so ancient that it has no bearing on the present, when actually, you know, like 1915 was only like 2 seconds ago in the grand scheme of life. I think sometimes as well, actually, as a side note, the way that historical figures and historical events are captured kind of makes us feel like it's far away. Like one of the things I think about is how when pictures are in black and white, you can forget that it wasn't that long ago. Like when you look at the civil rights, like pictures from the civil rights era, and you look at like figures like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or whoever it is, sometimes you can just feel so disconnected from them, like feel like it was another time, another century, another like an age ago. When to be honest, like it is so recent that like Martin Luther King's wife only died in 2006. Or like that little girl who was the first girl, forget her name, it's Ruby something, that little girl who was the first girl to go to a desegregated school, like she's on Facebook, like she's still alive and walking around. So again, like we've got a warped perception of how long ago things were. And I think sometimes it's just how we remember things, how we like place them like in the public's consciousness in such a way as to be made to feel like it was a long time ago. And I think part of it is probably intentional. Now, clearly there's a reason why companies like Citigroup would like to distance themselves from their past. And of course, one of the ways in which people distance themselves from things is by implying or pretending as though things were so long ago that it forms part of ancient history and therefore not worth discussing. So maybe part of the reason why we see so many black and white pictures of Martin Luther King and other historical figures like that, even though they were photographed in color at the time, is that they probably just want to distance themselves from like the nasty past that's associated with how those figures were treated. And so like when you go into the webpage of a company like Citigroup and you see that they have chronicled every accomplishment their company has ever achieved is listed on their website. So they'll tell you that they're like a long-lasting institution that was founded in 1812. They'll tell you all about their various mergers with different companies over the years and major milestones, but then they'll omit the fact that they colonized Citigroup, that they colonized Haiti, and that they financially exploited Haiti for many years during the occupation and after the occupation, and also that their success today is not incidental to what they did in Haiti, but is in fact can be explained because of that exploitation. Because you can't tell me that when you, and I think I did a, I feel like I did an episode on this as it relates to colonization and countries who are rich today because of what they did in colonization, because they engage in colonization. But same in the corporate world, like many of these companies act as though they were successful in spite of slavery, or they were successful after slavery or after colonization, or put another way, that their success was incidental to like the slave trade or incidental to colonization, when in fact it was instrumental. It was because they were able to effectively benefit from slavery or colonization in this case, or a combination of both in the case of Citigroup, that they are where they are today, that they've been able to stand the test of time because they took those massive profits that they gained over decades and they were able to invest in their own organization and expand internationally, like onwards and upwards. So honestly, it's not incidental. It's not like a minor component of their success. It's actually the core reason in many ways. And if you doubt this, you can just imagine being a business owner and you have the wealth of an entire nation at your disposal. You can't tell me that that's not going to distinguish you from regular businesses that only have access to small capital, either from friends and family or because they've been able to get a modest loan from their bank. So again, like it's instrumental in their success. Now, the thing about Citigroup and its treatment of Haitian people and the Haitian nation is that sadly, they're not that unique. Unique maybe in the scale. So only other companies like Unilever at one point practically owned Nigeria, or other companies like Barclays that financed a lot of companies that participated in colonization, or Lloyd's, for example, like those are probably on a similar level as Citigroup, but other companies also benefited from either slavery or from businesses related to slavery directly. One of those companies that no longer exists is Lehman Brothers. And actually my partner took me to see a theater show based on the lifetime of the corporation that was Lehman Brothers, called the Lehman Trilogy in London. It was really long. It was like 3.5, nearly 4 hours. And anyway, in that story, they basically recount a story of that can be summarized as like the typical or classic American dream. You have three brothers from Bavaria who immigrate to the United States in hopes of finding political freedom and economic economic success, essentially, or financial success. They end up settling in Alabama, and they start trading cotton to local producers. And after a few years, they end up being incredibly successful in that trade. What they decide to do after experiencing such like immense success in the South is that they decide to diversify their business. So they initially go up north and they set up like factories manufacturing textiles where they imported the cotton from the South. But after a few years, they end up making the transition into being a bank, into running as a financial institution. I've left out a lot of detail because honestly, it's not that important. But the summary is they start out trading cotton, they become wildly successful, they expand into the north, they start operating factories, then they decide to go into finance because they see that as being highly profitable. So the thing about the Lehman Brothers story and narrative, as I saw it in one, the Lehman Trilogy theater show that my partner took me to, and also if you look at the history of the Lehman Brothers, like on Wikipedia or on public sources, you will notice that they always omit the fact that the brothers were slave drivers. They owned at least 20 slaves. And one of them, by the way, they bought when she was like 13. There's a couple of them where they bought like a mother and her two children. One of them was like 2 years old. So they bought people who were enslaved. They were slave drivers, and they benefited from obviously that free slave labor. But also during that period when they moved to the North, there was a revolution in financing taking place where the financialization of enslaved people was taking place. And what that effectively meant was that many businesses were able to get loan by using enslaved Africans, enslaved people as collateral. And that's one of the ways in which the Lehman Brothers were able to get money for them to expand into the North and for them to expand their businesses. They used the people that they owned as collateral to get loans. And on top of that, they also used them for free labor in the manufacturing or production of the cotton that they used in their textile factories. So clearly, slavery and the exploitation of Black people, African people, African Americans is instrumental and extremely important in the narrative of the Lehman Brothers. And omitting it is kind of like having a story that is set in 1939 to 1945 Nazi Germany, where you have a family that is directly benefiting from the Holocaust and the exploitation of Jewish people. And then when you tell the story, like a century later, you don't talk about the Nazi government, you don't talk about the fact that they exploited Jewish people in the Holocaust, and you don't talk about how they were extremely profitable because they participated in the exploitation. So it's completely not only disingenuous, because I kind of feel like disingenuous is like putting it lightly, I would say it's so sinister as to be like tantamount to propaganda. It's a complete like rewriting of history that hides incredibly important contexts that explains where a company is right now. Ooh, actually, I just thought of the perfect parallel. It's like telling the story of how Volkswagen, like the car manufacturer, came to be, and for you to omit the fact that it was a car that was produced by the Nazi party. It's literally called the People's Car, and it not only was produced by the Nazi regime and financed by the Nazi regime, it also manufactured armored vehicles that the Nazis used in their fight against the Allies. So leaving out the fact that it was like a Nazi-financed, produced car company would be like such a laughable omission because it removes all context to the company. That's the same thing with Citigroup, the same thing with Lehman Brothers. Just to flag one company that, you know, we can give it like a tiny bit of props is JP Morgan, although they did do this at like, you know, because they were forced to, they didn't do it willingly. But JP Morgan in 2005 admitted finally that it had accepted like 13,000 slaves as collateral over like their period of operation, and that they had taken like physical possession of like more than 1,200 slaves as capital, like physically knew where they were and they belonged to JP Morgan. So a lot of these companies honestly have this past. Like when you look at like the biggest corporations that exist right now, especially ones that have monopolies, especially ones that have been able to endure, and especially ones that were founded like in the 1800s and between the 1800s and 1900s, it's always interesting interesting and worthwhile to delve into their past, because I tell you, like, 5 times out of 10, they probably have like bad roots or evil roots. And by the way, the reason for that is very simple. And that is because, like, for example, the exploitation of Black people was just so common back then that many companies, that just was the way they operated. It wasn't a moral question. It wasn't an ethical question. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. It was very routine, so routine as to be mundane. And so that's why many companies have this history. It's not because it was the particularly evil ones that did bad things. It literally just operated in an environment where those kinds of views and those kinds of like ethical standards were what was prevalent at the time. Now, against this backdrop of what I just spoke about the relationship between Citigroup and Haiti, its lobbying of the government, the impact it had in Haiti, its financial exploitation of Haitians, its complete domination and control of financial and monetary policy, its enduring impact in the fact that even up until 2013, Haiti was still paying off some of the debts that Citigroup had accrued, and then also covering other companies like Lehman Brothers, but also like Volkswagen, also like the Barclays and the Lloyds of the world. Against this backdrop, I think we can now talk about DEI again. Now, in last week's episode, I gave some of the criticisms of DEI about how sometimes it's implemented irresponsibly, sometimes because the company isn't actually devoted to DEI, so they just implement policies haphazardly. Other times because DEI is implemented, but there aren't diverse voices in the room, and so the outcome of those initiatives aren't successful because they don't have the perspective and the lens of diverse people. Now I want to focus on the importance. The first thing that always comes to mind for me is, even just on a basic philosophical, ethical, moral level, we have to right historical wrongs. Because if companies can benefit in the here and now from the behaviors that they engaged in their there and then, why shouldn't we also hold them accountable to the bad things that they did? Why should they be able to walk away scot-free, and not face any kind of consequences? Not social consequences, not financial consequences. I think on a basic level, that's unethical. I also think that we have long established the idea that we can hold governments and companies to account for things that they've done wrong. So, for example, Germany paid reparations to the Jewish community for what they did to the Jewish population during that period of the 1930s and 1940s. And honestly, they've been paying that for a very long time. Or, for example, the US has paid reparations to what it did to Japan by dropping the atomic bomb on their cities. In general, we accept the notion that there's a moral obligation that follows from companies and countries doing bad things, or even when companies are found to have like willingly and knowingly like been selling products that hurt people or harm people. We hold them to account, even though it happened historically, even though sometimes those people are no longer alive, we still make them pay something. We make them their pockets hurt, we hold them accountable in a monetary way and also in a public acknowledgement way. So the first reason I think DEI is important is that it's an attempt at righting historical wrongs. And it rights them through the mechanism of recognizing that certain groups of people are going to be disadvantaged over other people. So presumably Haitians in the US context are inherently going to be disadvantaged because their country was invaded and occupied and exploited for many years by the US government. And that's why many Haitians have been forced to emigrate to countries like the United States, because of the enduring legacy of slavery and occupation by foreign powers. And so DEI recognizes that and gives certain groups essentially like a helping hand. There's a recognition that they have had to work harder to be in the same position. So somebody who's had to emigrate because of US actions, by the way, who there's going to be lots of knock-on effects. Like, there's not going to be generational wealth. They are going to be disconnected from their family and from their support structure because they've had to immigrate. They're going to be behind in many different ways that is outside their control, that is a direct function of what the United States has done. And also, by the way, there's also psychological knock-on effects that comes from being the target of such, like, state-level terrorism, essentially. You are, for example, people talk about intergenerational trauma within the African-American community because there's no way there's not going to be some level of dysfunction that arises from having been terrorized for centuries by your government. So there's going to be an impact on trust, for example, on family dynamics, on the propensity for familial connections to break down in particular ways. Or even in another component of DEI, when you consider how women sometimes will behave in very patriarchal ways, even though it's against their own interests. So we often talk about Trump supporters who have literally voted for their own oppression. So on the one hand, like, women have gained all these rights over the past 70, 80 years or so. And in some odd ways, a segment of the population, a segment of the female population, pines for a time when they were under the legal or social control of men. And that's not because they're sadists. That's not even because they don't value their own freedom and their own rights that they've acquired. It's the function of centuries of socialization where there was legally imposed ways of behaving, where women, for example, weren't allowed to own property or weren't allowed to vote or weren't allowed to make independent financial decisions, where they weren't able to instigate divorces from their husbands, where if they did divorce their husbands, often they would lose custody, or when they were in gay relationships, especially in the UK, that's what I know more about, they often lost custody to their children. And with the legal imposition of many of these things, there's also going to be social implications or social norms that develop from these legal impositions. One of those is just attitudes that become like acceptable ways of thinking and believing when it relates to women. So for example, there are loads of tropes about what are male or masculine qualities and what are female or feminine qualities. And you wouldn't be surprised to know that most of the feminine qualities relate to their inferiority or weakness in some way. So men, like the generalized notion or caricature or stereotype of a man is that he's got good leadership skills, that he's not emotional, that he's able to think rationally and critically, that he's good at STEM subjects, so he's good at maths, he's good at science, that he is, you know, not supposed to be burdened with like little things. And little things are like caring about his family in a nurturing sort of way, or he doesn't engage in gossip, or he focuses on big ideas and big things in the future. So that's like all mostly positive like stereotypes. When it comes to women though, like the idealized caricature of a woman is a woman who is somebody who is like soft-spoken, deferential, submissive, who's interested in like family building and concern for other people. She's self-sacrificing. She doesn't complain, or if she complains in a feminine way. But certainly the thing that defines her is the fact that she's not a natural-born leader, that she is not a rational thinker, so she's hysterical or emotional or emotionally driven. And then also that she's not good at essentially STEM or intelligent subjects. So she doesn't do math, so she doesn't do science. Like, she's naturally interested more in the social sciences. And as far as like her desires, like, she's so self-sacrificing and so deferential that she's not interested in power. She's not interested in getting things that benefit her. And also that she's not supposed to show emotions that imply self-possession or that imply agency or that imply having a desire for things for yourself. So she's not supposed to show anger. She's not supposed to show coveting. She's not supposed to be like to have a propensity to engage in adultery. She's not supposed to not like motherhood. Like, all the things that she likes are supposed to center around self-sacrifice and the serving of society and the serving of men. Naturally, what happens is that when women who are socialized in that kind of culture with those kinds of stereotypes that are deeply held by not just men, but also women, is she's going to behave in a very particular way in the workplace. Like, even before we get to the point where she applies for the job, like, the way that she goes about the application is going to differ from the way the men approach their applications. Men are often boastful. They often overinflate their accomplishments and their credentials and their achievements in previous roles, where women notoriously underplay their own achievements and their own accomplishments. And the net effect of that is, not only is the structure designed not to see them as competent or capable or worthy of giving opportunities to at the same rate as men, it also means that they themselves participate in their own disenfranchisement, shall we say, by believing what the patriarchy believes about them. So the idea of DEI is that you recognize these legal impositions and these social impositions that have been cultivated over centuries, honestly, to the disadvantage of women, and basically you try and right those wrongs. Another reason why DEI is incredibly important is that you have to intervene to help specific groups of people, because the things that have happened historically, like, have resulted in social beliefs that disadvantage those particular groups. So I've just spoken about how beliefs around what women are supposed to be and expectations around what their desires and capabilities are prevent them from being equal participants in the workforce and from being promoted and given opportunities at the same rate as men. That's all because those myths around what a woman is and what a woman wants and what a woman is capable of exists. And that sort of, those kinds of myths, those diversity myths, still persist even now, even with legal protection, they still persist. So, for example, one of the things that racist people will say is that they believe that diversity hires, quote unquote, are unqualified. And the reality is that they are actually often overqualified. Specifically in the US context, the most educated group as we know are African American women, but it's not as though you see them in, like, boardrooms as being, like, the main people who are running the way the corporate world is running. No, they're often incredibly incredibly underrepresented, because again, they're not given those opportunities despite having the highest level of education at a group level. And in fact, what ends up happening is often they are in positions in which they are highly overqualified for. They'll have all this education, and because they aren't promoted and aren't given those opportunities, the only way for them to survive financially and economically is to just take a position that might be beneath them education-wise and experience-wise, because otherwise they don't have any other opportunities. So DEI recognizes that the most qualified person doesn't always get the job based on some of the myths that we believe about diversity and specific segments of the population. And to be honest, that whole argument around diversity hires being more likely to be unqualified is a complete red herring anyway, because it assumes that corporate America is merit-based. But you can't believe in sexism and racism and also believe that we live in a meritocracy, because that's what sexism and racism is. It's the idea that segments of the population are disadvantaged politically, economically, legally, just because of their identity markers. So by definition, it means that men will get jobs over women, not because the men are more qualified, but because of sexism, because they believe certain things about men that they don't believe about women. Same with people of color. The reason why they are not in certain positions or in boardrooms or in leadership positions is not because they are incapable. It's because the power structure that decides who is hired and who is promoted believes certain stereotypes about white men that they don't believe about black men, to the disadvantage of black men. And luckily, you know, we've got a example right now of the convergence of sexism and racism coming together to advantage, like, white men over, for example, black women in the results of the US elections. So you have a situation where Donald Trump, a man who by all measure is incompetent, who has been notoriously been unsuccessful in many of his ventures, who is unaccomplished outside having inherited the Trump name and therefore the Trump legacy and the money that came with being a Trump because his father was very successful. He was elected over somebody who is highly experienced, highly educated. So Kamala Harris was an attorney general for California. She was a senator. She served as the vice president for 4 years. And despite this education and despite this experience, like real life, real world, relevant political, legislative experience, she still lost out to essentially like a reality star that is Donald Trump. Or even going back to when Trump ran against Hillary Clinton. Or even just deracializing it for a second and focusing on the sexism part, the fact that he ran against Hillary Clinton and won also speaks to the fact that we don't live in a meritocracy. Like, Hillary Clinton, by every single measure, should have been the next president over Donald Trump, in that she had 8 years of experience as a senator. She had served as Secretary of State under Obama for the 2 terms. She had also studied law, so she had a legal background. And in her track record, both in the Senate and as Secretary of State, she had done a good job. Meanwhile, the opposition, or the person she was running against, i.e. the Donald, had filed for bankruptcy like no fewer than 6 times, had filed for bankruptcy protection 11 times. And so literally by every measure you can imagine, this man is incompetent. He was incompetent when he ran against Hillary. He's incompetent when he ran against Kamala. And to be honest, like, that's why we're seeing the complete shit show that is the US government right now. Like, even going back to what I spoke about in a couple of episodes ago around what's happening with the aviation industry and how planes are falling out of the sky every other day. Or if you saw the recent videos of Trump speaking with Zelensky, where he completely humiliated a world leader who is seeking the support and protection from the US. And by the way, like, they invited like the Ukraine's president there. So they invited Zelensky there, clearly intending to humiliate them. Like, if you look at the way J.D. Vance approached the conversation and the little glimpse and glances that he would throw at Trump, they clearly planned on ambushing him. Same if you look at, not an ambush, but if you look at just like the kinds of conversation that Trump had with the president of France, Macron, a few weeks back, where he's just in the Oval Office making up what can only be described as just complete lies. And typically other people are polite and they allow him to get away with some of his lies when it's in person, whereas Macron had to like correct him in real terms. And at one point, Trump was telling so many lies and so animated that Macron literally takes his hands and places them over Donald Trump's hands and holds them down to like tell him to basically like stop speaking. Which, BTW, I genuinely do think that he has dementia. There's like lots of evidence and articles and analysis about why that is, or the evidence for that. But even outside the dementia claims, like, clearly this is not the epitome of excellence and intelligence and leadership and capability. This is not, like, this is what happens when racism rewards like mediocre white men or incompetent white men or dangerous white men, or what happens when sexism makes these kinds of men have power that they honestly clearly do not deserve, because not only has he squandered it, but he's also weaponized it to the detriment of the government he's supposed to serve and to the detriment of the people he's supposed to serve. So again, going back to that trope of like diversity hires don't deserve their positions or they're unqualified, that's assuming that racism gives white people roles that they deserve. Like, that's not the case. Or that's assuming that sexism gives men roles that they deserve. That's clearly not the case either. Now, the final reason I'll talk about on why DEI is so important is because there are a lot of Trumps around in our everyday life. So there are people who hold racist views, sexist views, and who are sympathetic to like alt-right causes and to sexist causes. They are in positions of power every day, like in regular jobs. They're working at the post office. They're working at your bank. They're working at your water company or utility companies. They're working at just everyday jobs, and they hold these beliefs whilst also holding positions of power. So they decide who gets hired. they decide who gets promoted. And ultimately, when you don't have DEI, specifically DEI that is effective, so it measures real data points. It sets targets and says, the workforce should represent general society, and we are giving the company X amount of years to achieve that goal. And we measure how far they've come and how far they've missed achieving that goal. And importantly, there are consequences to not achieving those goals. We need that, because otherwise, like, those people are, there's no accountability. There's no way to hold them to account. There's no way to get them to stop enforcing their worldviews to the disadvantage of people of color and women, for example. So without DEI, all you're saying is you're going to allow the people who already have power to continue to hire in their image and to continue to hire according to their values. Now, one of the things that I often notice about people who, like, are innocent people, they're good people, is sometimes they find it difficult to conceptualize the idea that other people aren't good, that other people are bad, that they do evil things or bad things or immoral things. And that's why when they walk into a space, for example, that is all white and all male, often it won't occur to them that it's clearly a company that has racist and sexist hiring practices, because for them, they're not thinking in those terms, because that's not how their mind operates. And because that's not how their mind operates, they find it difficult to just make that connection. It's the same reason why, because most people are good people, I believe, when they hear of like murder or a rape, they find it so difficult to understand the motivation for that rape or that murder. And they find it very difficult to accept the notion that bad people do bad things because they get off or they enjoy doing that bad thing. It brings them pleasure, it satisfies them, or it advantages them in some way, and they're willing to do that. Like, they find it difficult to accept that because it's an ugly truth. Similarly, when you walk into an office building, for example, and it's in an office building in a city, I'm not talking about places where it's like monoculture. If you go to like a rural city in Poland, for example, where everybody is white, of course it's normal that everybody in that office is going to be white. But if you're in a place like New York or in a place like London that is highly, highly diverse, yet you walk into an office building or some company or some organization and they are like virtually all white and virtually all male, or put another way, they clearly don't reflect like the workforce or the society, that is by design. That is by intention. It means that the people who decide who are hired, who is hired and who gets promoted and who gets to stay or who gets given an opportunity, they've decided to hire only white people, only people in their image. It also implies that people who are comfortable with like racism are going to gravitate towards those positions or to those organizations, because there are people who want to only work in white spaces, or who only want to work with other white people, or who have negative or derogatory views of people of color, and so they don't want to work with them. Similarly, there are men who only believe that men are competent, or they only have positive view of women. And so for them, it feels normal or natural or good or desirable to only work with other men. So again, like, you shouldn't think of it as it being like incidental. Like, it takes a lot of people to participate in making that office or organization appear in that specific way in terms of the demographics. The second thing you should realize when you walk into those all white, all male spaces, or nearly all white and all male, is that it is also a reflection of the subconscious bias that must be endemic in the company. Because for a company to be all white and all male, pretty much in like a metropolitan city like London, for example, it requires their participation of nearly everybody. Because presumably, if people felt uncomfortable with racism, they would feel uncomfortable in working in all white spaces when they live in metropolitan and diverse cities. And so the fact that they walk in every day and they don't feel discomfort, or they don't think, hang on a second, this is very, very weird, or I feel uncomfortable, or does anybody else see what I'm seeing? It means that they are okay with the status quo, because they're okay in that they believe the natural order of things, the way that society should be made up as reflected in the workforce, is for it to be a reflection of themselves. So male or white, for example, in the examples that I'm giving. And I said that was the last point, but actually I'll end on this. One of the things that we don't realize about DEI as well is that it's not just that it can be implemented in a way that is ineffective, like I spoke about last week, where they will just use somebody in a tokenistic way because they don't understand nuance, or they don't understand like the implications of using that particular person. So last week I spoke about giving Woman of the Year to Caitlyn Jenner, and in the context of one, Caitlyn Jenner not being supportive of women in general and having sexist views and homophobic views, as we've come to know now. The idea of giving her a Woman of the Year award when she's only been a woman for 12 years and hasn't done anything for women is it's a tokenistic way of going about DEI. So I spoke about that last week, but there's also another version of the weaponization of DEI where they use marginalized people to basically affirm what they believe already. So an example of this is they will, let's say they adhere to European standards of beauty and they only believe that white women are beautiful. What they will do when they are forced to be more inclusive and forced to hire diverse models is that they will hire models that are, objectively speaking, of a less beautiful. And they will pretend as though that's not evident to them. So they'll have a campaign that has like five models. Four of them will be tall, thin, beautiful white women. And then for the fifth model, they'll have like a morbidly obese black woman who clearly isn't as attractive, like facially. You can look at that and say, well, it's great that they are being representative in all these different ways. They're being representative in size, in size in this way, and color, obviously. But no, like they could have chosen a black woman who was as beautiful as the white women who've been presented. They specifically are doing it in a cheek and tongue kind of way. Like, you know, when you do things according to the letter, but not the spirit, it's like, okay, you want diversity, I'll give you diversity, but they're not doing it in a socially responsible way. Because presumably little black girls also want to feel beautiful by seeing themselves represented in this luxurious or feminine or extraordinary way. And so when you don't give them the equivalent, it's reinforcing the idea and the notion that they are inferior. So that's an example of like weaponizing DEI, almost doing it in bad spirit. Like, I'll give it to you, but I'll give it to you in a very irresponsible way. Another form of weaponization of DEI is when they use people of color or marginalized people to basically do the dirty bidding of the power structure. By that, I mean, there are certain things that will go down very badly if it's said by a white male politician. So if he speaks up and says, actually, I think that maternity cover is very expensive. Like, paying women to be away when they're giving birth and to have time with their baby, that's very expensive to the organization, and we don't think that the organization should be responsible for that cost. It sounds very ugly coming from a man. So what they will do is that they will hire a woman who has those same beliefs to have them be the spokesperson or the mouthpiece of what the organization or the power structure wants. We literally have that example right now where the head of the opposition party, the Conservatives in the UK, a woman called Kemi Badenoch, has been saying those exact same things. So she has been literally advocating for the removal of maternity protection, maternity pay for women, when like even the most right-wing conservative male politician would never say that. But they've obviously put her in that position to get her to pass something that they know they couldn't pass without her. Similarly, a few years ago, we had our first chancellor, who's basically the treasury secretary, who was a black man. And under his reign, which was very short-lived, he tried to pass the most right-wing, extremist policies, economic policies. Like, he literally was advocating for like no tax for the rich, like complete tax breaks from complete deregulation, just saying stuff that even like conservative like voters or conservative leaning people would never dream that that would ever happen, because the population as a whole would be completely against it. Like, it could be the beginning of civil unrest. That's how extreme his policies were. Now, he was quickly removed, but the general point though is that think of all the qualified Black people in the United Kingdom who hold centrist conservative views around the economy, around politics. Why have they chosen to choose the most extremist Black people to be representative of a conservative party? Clearly it's because they're testing the waters. They want to see how much they can get away with if they have those same views come out not from the mouths of a white man, but come out from the mouths of a Black woman, for example, in the case of Kemi, or a Black man in the case of Kwasi Kwarteng. So again, that's an example of the weaponization of DEI, where either they do it in the letter but not the spirit. So they give you DEI, but they do it in such a way where you're like, well, that's not really what we're asking for. Or they give it to you, but in a way that still serves the interests of the power structure. So that's something to be aware of, that not all DEI is equal, and it's important to recognize when it's being misappropriated or being weaponized against us. And it's also important to remember that the context of an organization really, really matters. So the way in which a company like Citigroup, with the history that it has with Haiti, and I'm sure we looked a bit deeper in other countries, the way that a company like that, with that history and that context and that background, especially because it has made no effort whatsoever to like admit what it did and to publicly acknowledge and to find a resolution or find some way of righting those historical wrongs, that kind of company is not going to implement DEI initiatives in a way that is impactful. In fact, it's probably going to do it in a very tokenistic way. And on top of that, you can tell that companies like that, companies like Citigroup, were never truly committed to DEI, because you can tell from the speed with which they abandoned those initiatives. With Citigroup in particular, they only actually started implementing DEI initiatives in 2018. So they, on the one hand, have a history of benefiting from slavery and colonization that goes back centuries, but then their DEI initiatives, so an attempt to right those historical wrongs indirectly, because obviously they never admit to what they've done, that only lasts like 7 years. The reason why it lasts 7 years is because they were never truly committed to DEI. And it also implies that within the company, in a very like deeply ingrained way, that company clearly still has values that are a continuation of the kinds of values a company must have to engage in colonization of a country. A country, by the way, that was already on its knees or just getting off its knees at the time. And so I don't think that you can, I personally don't think you can look at them in a neutral way or in a way that ignores their historical context, because you're missing out all the information. You're missing out all the clues on what is driving their actions, whether it's coming from a good place, a genuine place, or whether it's probably just like a PR stunt. And in Citigroup's case, clearly it was just a marketing strategy. They were just doing it because other companies were doing it. And moreover, they never really truly believed in the value of diversity and of hiring people from diverse backgrounds. And so with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode and were able to listen to the very end. If you have any comments for me, if you know any facts that I didn't cover about Citigroup or other companies like Lehman Brothers or JP Morgan, who else did I mention? I think I didn't mention Brooks Brothers, but Brooks Brothers also has a history rooted in benefiting from slavery. Or if you have any history or tidbits or information about those companies, I'd be really interested in knowing. I love reading about that stuff. Other than that, you know, have a great week, and I'll catch you next Monday. And BTW, this is coming out a little bit earlier than last week, so I think I'm doing a bit better. Thanks again, and catch you next Monday.